From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We could use a little laughter these days, but why is that? What does laughter do? How's it work? It turns out there's a science to it. Like everything else, babies laugh 300 times a day. Adults, maybe 20. The more, the merrier, we say. This hour, On Point, laughter, the science of laughing. With us now from Baltimore, Maryland, is Robert Provine, professor of psychology at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, assistant director of the neuroscience program there. He's been tracking laughter for a long time. He's author of Laughter, a Scientific Investigation. Robert Provine, thanks very much for being with us today.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst, my buddy in laughter, Jack Beatty. Thanks, Jack, for joining us today.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Robert.
What a laugh. We got a lot we want to listen to in this hour. Robert Provine, take us right back. You say laughter comes from the monkeys, from the chimps. It's a gift from evolution. How? Why?
Well, basically, laughter is the sound of labored breathing and rough and tumble play. For example, if you listen to chimpanzees laugh, and humans aren't the only ones that do it, if you tickle a chimpanzee, they'll give their own unique laugh. And I'll give you a sample of it.
Okay.
It sounds like panting.
So how do you know that's a laugh and not just panting? I mean, how do you?
Well, you tickle them.
Yeah.
And they make a unique facial expression called a play face that you would think, oh, this is laughter. But when you analyze the sound, it's a different sound, and it's produced in a somewhat different way.
Could we hear that once more, Doctor?
Okay. Sounds like a dog panting.
Okay.
But that's where it all came from. So the pant-pant of the chimpanzee was transformed into the human ha-ha. But that's where it all started.
You can hear the chimp in the ha-ha today? Can you demonstrate that for us? What's the link?
Okay, well, basically modern human laughter is the sound of labored breathing and rough and tumble play. It's just one step removed where instead of going pant-pant, we go ha-ha. So human laughter has its origin in play. But if you look at the chimps and other primates, their laughter is associated with rough and tumble and physical things. Well, in humans, it's associated with more cognitive and linguistic stimuli, such as humor.
We're going to dive into all this. Jack Beatty, I want to come to your laughter, your labored breathing and rough and tumble play, how much of what goes on at your house. But here I've got a little bit. This is from a BBC News video. This is a gorilla, we're told, giggling while his trainer tickles him. Okay, there's gorilla laughter. Let's turn it over and hear a little laughter. This is an eight-month-old. Robert Provine says babies laugh a lot. This is eight-month-old Micah MacArthur laughing hysterically, so funny, as his father Marcus rips up a job rejection letter in a video that went viral last year. Talk about contemporary job rejection. The baby laughs. We got gorillas, we got babies, and we've got the guys right down the hall here at my radio station, NPR's The Car Talk guys, Tom and Ray. They always seem to have a good laugh. Let's listen to that. All right. Now that is laughter. That is human laughter. Jack Beatty, do you feel yourself in this line of descent from the gorilla and the chimp to the baby to Tom and Ray? Are you in that arc of evolution, Jack?
I am there, and I do rough and tumble play with my 97 pound lab.
Your
and
dog,
boy,
okay.
You should hear me. Yeah. He groans. Yeah. and we have a ball. You know, what I'm curious about, Robert, is what is the evolutionary edge that this gives humans and chimps? In other words, do we have something going for us here that other species don't because we can laugh?
Yes, one of the things that makes mammals and certainly primates such as ourselves special is play. Like lizards can do a lot of impressive things, but they don't play. It takes a mammal. So laughter is the sound of play. And laughter, like other sounds, is a vocalization that we make to change the behavior of other people, just like I'm talking to you right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of unconscious, instinctive vocalization. It's the first form of communication between caregivers and babies. And then later in life, it's an important means of establishing social bonds between our adult playmates, colleagues, friends, family, lovers.
So laughter lubricates play. You write about it lubricating a lot of other things as well. Things that last in evolution have a reason, and to Jack's point, to elaborate on that. I mean, I guess we have an intuitive sense of why play is important, but why does play give us an evolutionary edge?
Well, play is practice for things in life. The give and take, you know, imagine tickle battles. The give and take of tickle battles binds people together in social relationships. And later in life, it also binds us together in sexual ones.
We'll get to that too, promise. But you say the oldest joke in the world comes out of this vein, maybe. What do you think is the most ancient joke in the world?
My candidate for the oldest joke would be feign play. It's the only joke you can tell both to a human baby and a chimpanzee.
Feigned play like what?
Like, I'm going to get you, I'm going to get you. It doesn't really count if you tickle them because you would be actually evoking the response. But simply the threat of tickling would be my candidate for the most ancient joke.
And the interesting thing is you say that most laughter, though we associate it, I mean, these days there's so many laugh tracks out there, we'll look at that. But we associate it with comedy, with humor. You say it's much more abundant, actually, in just lubricating social interaction.
Yeah, if you go out in the world and look at what people actually do, you know, there's a lot of surprises. We found that maybe only 10 or 15% of all laughter follows anything that's remotely jokey. So it turns out the essential ingredient for laughter is not a joke, it's another person.
And sometimes just to say hi, here's Bill Cosby and his friend Tito Puente just saying hi.
Tito Puente.
My man, Tito Puente. You like him? Yeah.
He's playing there in Roseland this weekend.
This weekend.
All right, Jack Beatty, there they are. They're happy to see one another. Cosby and Puente laugh a little bit, and you're in the groove together.
They are. And yet, when you try humor with people and it doesn't work, you're aware of just, suddenly the abyss opens before you. I was talking to a couple that just came back from Finland.
Yeah,
and the Finns speak English, but efforts at humor do not go very far, at least American humor, in Finland. And in fact, someone has said that there is only one Finnish joke.
Oh, come on.
And the joke is that the Russians are invading from the east, the Germans are invading from the west. Which side does Finland... How do they decide what to do? And the answer, the punchline to the only Finnish joke is... We fight the Germans first, business before pleasure.
Gosh, if that's the only joke, there are going to be some long, cold winters there. I mean, Robert, really, do jokes just have that deep a backseat to saying hi and social lubrication?
Yes, they are. For example, in whose presence do you usually laugh? It's usually friends, family, lovers. Mm-hmm. These are people you have relationships with. You don't usually have laughing relationships with strangers. But when you look at laughter, we're really looking at a human universal. All members of our species speak laughter in pretty much the same way. So all the cases of laughter you had, whether it's click or clack or your own, mm-hmm. short bursts of sound that are about a 15th of a second long that repeat every fifth of a second. So that's part of this ancestral code. It sounds really odd if you laugh too fast or too slow, like or ha, 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 doesn't sound like laughter. And you just laughed right then.
Yes.
And actually, that was interesting in several ways. First of all, laughter is not under conscious control.
It could be. You mean it never is? We can never deliberately laugh?
Yeah. Will you laugh for me now?
Well, it's funny to think about trying to laugh for you, so I guess I could in that way, but...
Okay, well, you just laugh spontaneously.
Yeah.
But I found over half the people you ask to laugh on command will say, well, I can't laugh just because you asked me to. And actually, that's a very important thing, because we go through life laughing, and it's a behavior that's really not under control. In the right social situations, it just happens.
It does. I guess, Jack, the thing that seems to run under an awful lot of laughter, yes, is that desire to be warmly engaged with other people. There may be all kinds of dynamics around that, but also just the absurdity of life, which is so abundant. And how else to deal with it? I mean, there's laughter. What other tool do we have?
Oh, it's a coping mechanism, nonpareil. You just can't beat it. The absurdity of life and one's own absurdity. where would we be if we couldn't laugh at ourselves? I mean, Mark Twain said the human species is the only one that blushes and needs to blush. That's true, but also the only one that laughs at itself, or at least it seems that's the case. I wonder, does that distinguish us from the apes?
We'll come back and look at that. Twain also saying, against the assault of laughter, nothing can stand. It can be powerful in that way. It can be wielded, maybe, in that way. Behind us right here, and we'll come back and talk about it, a 1922 recording, jazz recording, the OK Laughing record. The lore is that the audio engineer decided to keep recording a botched jazz session where the crew ends up doing more laughing than playing. I don't know if that's spontaneous or that's for the recording album, but there it is. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. They sound like the zoo, but it's humans right there. A woman, 9 months pregnant, laughing as her son marches around the room in his underwear. And maybe we've been there. We're talking this hour about laughter and the science of laughter. Robert Provine is with us from the University of Maryland, professor of psychology there, author of Laughter, a Scientific Investigation. Jack Beatty is with us as well. What do you think? Can you feel yourself huffing like a chimpanzee when you laugh? Can you feel the evolutionary link? And when's the last time you just laughed so hard you couldn't stop? A little YouTube laughter there, just going on and on as a little boy marches around the room in his underwear. Now, that's interesting to me, Robert Provine, because you know the one we heard before the break, these jazz musicians in 1922 laughing on and on, I got to say that didn't pass my believability test. To my ear, that sounded like they were being theatrical, you know, sort of laughing on purpose for the recorder here. This family, that seems like a situation that we've all known one time or other, seemed pretty real. What about the issue of credibility and laughter? When you believe it, when you don't, Robert?
Well, people laugh their way through lives, and we're not very acute observers of our own behavior, but we're very keen in detecting when other people do something that seems to be artificial, whether it be artificial laughter or artificial crying. Mm-hmm. The case in the laugh record you had, actually, that's one of the most famous novelty records of all time, the OK Laugh record.
Okay.
It was so popular that all sorts of other great musicians, maybe who should have known better, gave it a shot, like Sidney Bechet, Louis Armstrong, Woody
Herman.
Let's
play a little, laugh a little, let's let her rip. Was that the idea?
Well, they knew that the OK record was successful, and they wanted to try their hand at it. Probably the most successful one other than that one was the Spike Jones takeoff on the interrupted solo instrumental that was Flight of the Bumblebee. But a lot of people had tried it because they thought, hey, it's fun. Maybe we can earn some extra money because the OK Laugh record worked.
I don't know, Jack. Were you going with that one? I mean, I know there's such a thing as infectious laughter, but it sounded to me like some folks just laughing on purpose for the tape recorder.
Yeah, I mean, and the fact that they were theater people, generically, made it more suspect. If it had been around somebody's dinner table, yeah, I agree, it would have a little more credibility.
Let's hear from our listeners right here. Nelson in Buffalo, New York. What makes you laugh, Nelson?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Usually slapstick comedy. I was just, I watched Seinfeld last night,
yeah.
And I probably watched every episode, and it's probably Kramer, you know, falling down and so forth. I mean, I know the lines, I know what they're going to say, but I still laugh at it. And the old Home Alone movies, that sort of thing. Just the other day, I dumped my bicycle. I kind of rolled onto the pavement, and
yeah.
I banged myself up, and I think I'm okay, but I've got a crutch now, and I'm using that to get around. And last night, sitting on the couch with my wife, she had fallen asleep, and I took the crutch and I started poking her with it. And I don't know. I just found it funny. And she woke up, and she, of course, was a bit aggravated with me. But I found that humorous.
Brave man, and maybe man's the operative word. Funny to poke wife with crutch. Just picture that, Robert Pervine. What about gender and laughter? Do men and women
actually
laugh
one of the definitions of comedy and tragedy is. This is a common one.
Yeah.
Tragedy is when I cut my finger. And comedy is when you fall into a manhole and die.
Yeah. Well, actually, I don't know. I followed that. I thought it was when you cut your finger.
Okay. One of the key issues in whether it be comedy or just generating laughter is other people. So you could have some of the world's greatest comedy material.
Yeah.
If you're listening to it at home alone, it's not going to work. So if you're listening to comedy, listen to it with friends, because ultimately it's social. You know, for example, a comedian would find it very difficult to do a performance in front of two people nursing warm beers. Okay, you need an audience. It is social. We laugh when we hear other people laugh.
You write about
it's just you.
You have written about, I think, infectious laughter. And where was it? Tasmania or somewhere where the people got caught up in laughter that lasted for a year? Am I right?
Yeah, it was Tanzania, a laugh epidemic. Actually, this was first covered in the front page of the New York Times. Is you had some middle school age girls in Tanzania starting to laugh, and then it caused others to laugh, and it was so disruptive, they dismissed school. And the fits of laughter came and went over a period of months, and it took a couple of years for it to ultimately die out.
Do you believe that, or does it sound apocryphal to you? You're the scholar here. Do you believe a year-long laughter fit?
In various degrees that I do, because we've all experienced some of it. I don't know if you've experienced it on air. But usually Christmas parties of television and radio stations will have some material while a person's on air doing a weather broadcast or something. Start to laugh, and try as they might, they just can't stop.
Yeah, some famous examples of that. And the gender piece, you've written about men and women and how they laugh differently, maybe at different things or in different ways.
You know, men are the leading laugh-getters. And women are the primary audience for this.
What's that about? Is this mating
rituals? We did a study of thousands of In Search of personal ads in newspapers, and we found that men offer their sense of humor and women solicit it. We have a market going here. But women, when they're looking for men with a sense of humor, they don't care if the guy laughs or not. They want to get their laughs in. And also, this works out very well because men are attracted to women who laugh in their presence, and women are attracted and interested in men who make them laugh.
Here's a little tape of a woman watching a video of her family dancing and, laughing.
Look at you!
Okay, Jack, I don't think that's a courting ritual right there, but that is somebody really having fun with the absurdity, in that case, of her own family.
Yes, and boy, home the whole sort of genre of funny home movies, I mean, just brings that home. One can see them. You know, a real dilemma, though, in any relationship is when a sure sign that it's not going to work is when you venture a joke and it just doesn't translate, or when you cite something you think is funny and that doesn't work. I remember talking about Jack Benny, who I still think is one of the funniest people I've ever seen, and I would enact his, you know, Benny was famously cheap, and the skit was someone would come up and hold him up, and the guy would say, "All right, your money or your life," and a long pause, the timing,
right.
and the guy would say, "Well,
considering,
I'm thinking, and I would tell that. And it sometimes it just wouldn't work. People would say, "I don't get that."
Yeah,
and Benny's an interesting character in that he's a great comedian, and he didn't really tell jokes. You know, it took Jack Benny to do that material.
Because, but it's the long pause, your money or your life, and he's got to wait and think about it just to figure it out. Boy, Knoxville, Tennessee, Tony's calling. Tony, you're on the air.
Hi. How are you guys today?
Pretty well. What do you know, Tony?
Very good. Well, I wanted to see if you had any insight on giggling. I noticed a lot of times everybody's experienced this once or twice in their life, if not more, where you're in church or in a serious business meeting, and you get the giggles, and for whatever reason, you cannot stop yourself from giggling. And a second part to that question, while I was on hold, I'm thinking about it, and I can't remember. It seems like it's mostly men that do that, and I didn't know if you had any insight on that.
You mean you sort of lose control of their giggling and just can't stop?
Well, in a serious situation where things should be serious and solemn, and you get the giggles, and you just cannot stop giggling, and there's no reason why you're giggling, but boy, you're stuck there, and you just can't stop.
Yeah,
you know it's a bad time to do it, and you cannot stop yourself for nothing.
Everybody's been there. I got a 5-year-old doing it right here, giggling away, Tony, with a bowl of yogurt. Why? I'm not quite sure, but let's listen. Okay, we know life is just a bowl of yogurt sometimes. What about the laughter that you can't stop, Robert? What's that about?
Okay, well, first of all, 3 points have come up in the last minute of conversation. First of all, notice that all the cases of laughter have to do with that pulsative vocalization, about a 15th of a second that repeats every fifth of a second.
I didn't notice that. Okay.
Well, actually, you do notice it because otherwise you wouldn't recognize it as laughter.
Okay, yeah.
The other one is, as our caller had suggested, when you start laughing, it's hard to stop. The same is true with crying. We don't laugh on command. We don't cry on command. But once it's underway, it's hard to terminate. And also, there's a lot of social sanctions about doing it at an inappropriate time. We may not pay any attention to laughter when it's the right time. But, for example, the laughing in church, or you're pulled off by a highway patrolman for speeding, that's probably not good time to laugh.
No,
definitely not.
Not good.
So there's a lot of sanctions when you break the laws of laughter.
Right.
In fact, laughter is so powerful. If you go back to Plato and Aristotle, they spent a lot of time thinking and writing about laughter because they feared its power. They said that laughter can cause a loss of respect of authority and could ultimately lead to the overthrow of the state.
Wow.
Thus, politicians' life is getting much worse if they're starting to become regular fare on comedy shows.
Be careful.
They were very much concerned with the power of laughter. In fact, laughing at the wrong person at the wrong time can get you killed.
Here's a little bit from a wedding in church, I guess. Instead of saying lawfully wedded wife, the groom accidentally says, "Waffly wedded wife," and the bride just can't get it together.
I've been scared of this all my life.
Okay, I don't know if it's a good start to the marriage or not. Waffly wedded wife there, maybe. Sue Gillen joins us right now from Chicago. Robert Provine, standby in Baltimore. Sue is a Second City alumni, actor, director, of course, the Second City, Chicago's famous sketch comedy and improv group. Lots of famous alums there, John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd and Bill Murray and a whole lot more. Sue, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom. How are you?
Oh, we're great. Do you guys ever sit around and think about the science of laughter, or would that be a joke?
Well, when I direct shows here, yes, you do have to break down what is it that's making this work, this scene or this sketch, and what is it that's making it not work.
I mean,
there's a little method to the madness.
Does it bum you out that our professor here says, you know, it's not mainly about comedy or deliberate humor. It's mainly, you know, sort of a social oil that we pour all over our lives just to keep things moving, working.
Well, you know, when you've got 300 people together in an audience, you do start to be able to tell what are they really relating to and jibing with, and what are they not particularly interested in. So then you have the ability to tweak those things that aren't working as well to make them hit just like the other pieces that are hitting really well. So, and what we find, you know, you touched a little bit on that truth in comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Here at the Second City, that's a really big mantra for us.
Mm-hmm.
We try to focus on relationships and characters that people can empathize with, relate to, and then we just start playing with the dials on them. So you can find a person who says the thing you wish you could say, and that's really funny because, look, I relate to this person, but now they're doing things I could never do, and that is making me laugh.
Now that gets interesting, Jack. I mean, there that, you know, you want comedy, look for truth, and truth will bring you to the laugh. Something there in human psychology, Jack, about, you know, just facing just how absurd and weird things can be. Tell it true, we'll laugh.
It's almost as if there's a collective unconscious. And when it leaks out, when someone says that true thing that we're all feeling down below, people go, yep, here's the moment of truth in this percussive laughter.
You know, Sue, Robert has timed laughter down to the millisecond. As a director or a comedian, when you're on stage and performing or watching the performance, are you gauging the nature, the particular nature of the laughter you're hearing and what that means about how the show's going?
Yeah, you can. There are all different kinds of laughs that you've heard on the clips that you've been playing. And we like them all. We like the raucous, I can't believe this is happening. We also love those that are a little smaller, but really relation-based, where people are nudging the person next to them and whispering, oh my gosh, that's you, or that's our Aunt Sally. We like every kind of laugh. But yeah, you can gauge them, and you can start to observe when you're directing a show. You can really keep your eye on the audience to determine how well the show is going rather than keeping your eye on the actors.
What about among professional humor creators? Is there a different quality of laughter, a different frequency of laughter? You know, Robert Provine finds age 5 is when people laugh the most. What about any age but in the writer's room? Is that funny time or not funny time?
It's a combo platter. Sometimes it is the funniest, funnest place to be on the planet, and other times it is bleak and grim and dark. Because when it's not flowing, you just, nothing feels worse than a room of people hired to be funny who just can't crank it out that particular moment. And we've all been there.
Sue, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
You talked about the audience of 300. What if you have an audience of 4 people sitting out there nursing warm beer? What kind of challenge is that for you?
I've done shows for 6 people. I think that's the smallest number I've ever done at a private dinner party. There were more actors than attendees, and it was incredibly uncomfortable. Still, you could see that they were enjoying it, but people are afraid to laugh if they think they're going to stand out. Once you get a crowd going, it's contagious in the sense that people don't feel they're going to be pointed at or singled out. I think that the fear that people have coming to a Second City show is that we're going to pick on them or we're going to single them out, and that is absolutely untrue. We just use suggestions to inspire the scenes that we create on stage. Certainly not the Gallagher smash a watermelon on the first 2 rows of your audience type of humor. So yeah, the more people you have, the easier it is to fill up the room with laughter. But people still enjoy it, even on a smaller scale.
Boy, but when that ocean of laughter gets going, what a fun thing to surf on. Sue Gillen at Second City in Chicago. Thanks for being with us for a minute, Sue.
Thanks so much for having me. Take care.
Great to have you. Bob Provine, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're going out here with I Love to Laugh. Brothers Richard and Robert Sherman won an Academy Award, Best Score, Mary Poppins, 1964-5. Robert Sherman died this week at age 86. Here's the song.
Love to laugh. Loud and long and clear. We love to laugh. So everybody can hear. The more you laugh. Oh my goodness. The more you feel.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking to you about laughing and the science of laughter. Some co-workers at a construction site right there having a very good time, and they are definitely not on stage. Just great captured laughter. Robert Provine is with us, author of Laughter, A Scientific Investigation. Jack Beatty's here. We've got lots of questions here online, Robert. Be Smart says, it is the best medicine. I OD on it every day. Mark says, why don't I do it as much anymore? I'm 38. We should talk about age and laughter. Matt says, are there health risks to never laughing? What about when we laugh the most in life, and what about how much we laugh in our health? Are there connections there, Robert?
Yes, laughter is literally the sound of play. Remember the pant, pant of the chimps to the human ha-ha? It's something you do when you play. So if there's less laughter in your life, there's less play. And also, since laughter is about relationships, if you're not around other people, you won't laugh much. So if you want to laugh more, don't worry about comedy videos. Spend more time with your friends.
Age. Now, I read somewhere in your work here, I think that five-year-olds laugh the most. What about that over the arc of age? Mark wants to know, he's 38 and he's not laughing so much.
Well, actually, I haven't counted laughter at people of different ages. But those ages that where you're going to have most play, for example, with children, are going to laugh the most. When you find older people laugh less, they play less, and they're around other people less.
Jack, do you have any sense in your own life of whether you've had, you know, decades of more laughter, decades of laughter, or are you less? Are you a steady state laugher, Jack? What do you say?
I think I'm an easy laugh. That's one thing. I love to laugh, and I'll do it at the slenderest provocation. So I've always been a laugher. But, you know, I was just thinking about laughter and power. And really, for Ronald Reagan, so much of his appeal as a human being was his ability to laugh at himself. He told jokes that were are one-liners that made him the butt of the joke. Lou Cannon points this out in his great biography. And again, he would sort of take the majesty out of it, take the highfalutin out of it by saying things like the founding fathers. And by the way, I remember them very well.
right.
Or when he was debating Walter Mondale, he said, "I will not hold my opponent's youth and inexperience against him," turning the tables on his own age, and he would do this again and again. And I think it was a crucial part of his leadership, and the feeling many people had, lots of Americans had, of being comfortable with him.
Yeah, that feeling of comfort. What do you say, Robert, about leadership, power, leaders making people around them comfortable through laughter?
Well, that's an important quality. When you think about, let's say, things that you want to see in a general, how many really funny generals are there?
Well,
usually
there's funny ha ha, and then there's the leader's sort of little joke that puts people at ease.
But people in position of power usually aren't known as really being funny. In fact, a politician, Morris Udall, actually titled his autobiography "Too Funny to Be President."
This is Plato and Aristotle's concern. Get them giggling too much, they're not going to take you seriously. And that
John Kennedy was unusual in being a very funny guy. Actually, he was the one that really popularized the television press conference. He was really good, and he was funny, but it's a fairly rare thing. It's interesting that you mentioned Reagan. Consider Nixon. How many cases are there of him ever laughing? He clearly was a person uncomfortable with himself.
Yeah, Jack, I do not recall much on those White House tapes of just howling laughter sessions.
There's also laughing with and laughing at. You know, we think of some of life's best moments. It's when laughing with friends and family. Some of the worst are when people laugh at you. So laughter is a kind of unconscious vocalization that may be produced to shape up others. You might be laughing at how a person is behaving, at their shirt. It's an effort to get them to shape up. So laughing with binds us together. Laughing at causes people to shape up. Or if they don't shape up, it can cause them to be driven away.
Kind of wield it like a knife there. Douglas in Shenandoah, Virginia. Thanks for calling, Douglas. You're on the air.
Hello there.
Hi.
Not a huge fan of David Letterman, but he had Barry White on doing the top 10 list.
Okay.
And there were 10 words that sounded sexy when spoken by Barry White. And, of course, they had three backup girls, so every time Barry White would say a word, they'd go, woo.
Barry White with that bedroom voice. And so what did he say? What words were on his list, Douglas?
Oh, I think the first one he started off was gingivitis. And it'd be, woo. So I guess my sense of humor leans toward irony.
Yeah, lean toward irony, and why not? Though, I mean, I don't know if it's purely ironic when Barry White says it, the most absurd word can take on this kind of tone. I mean, Tina's asking here now, speaking about laughter in the media, Tina asks Robert Provine, she says, what do we lose as a society now that so much of our public humor, i.e. television, is sarcastic or sardonic or laughing at others? Do we lose some of the emotional benefit of laughing when it's nonstop sardonic? What do you say, Bob?
Like, it's pretty much of a mix. But it's interesting to consider the origin of sardonic laughter. Actually, it probably had its origin in referring to sardonic smiling, which was a reaction to a poisonous plant that was growing in Sardinia. And that's where that expression came from. So it dates all the way back to the Odyssey, where you had Odysseus laughing uncontrollably.
But what about her
kind of murderous? Yeah. It was a kind of murderous laugh.
Well, exactly, and I think that goes to the heart of her question, which is quite contemporary. At the same time, you know, do you get this? I guess first of all, do you agree that there's an emotional benefit to laughter, and do you get that same emotional benefit if it's sardonic, if it's a murderous laugh?
I don't know. That's a tough one. I mean, it's hard enough to evaluate the correlates and consequences of laughter itself. When you subdivide it into sardonic and so on, makes it more of a challenge. But the idea, again, of sardonic laughter goes back to Homeric times. So it's certainly something that's not new.
Not new, but not on TV in Homeric times. Susie in Waltham, Massachusetts. Susie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I am a laughter yoga leader, and the name of my business is Celebrate Your Laughitude. And I am one of the people who was trained by Dr. Kateri in India, who realized that you do not have to laugh at a joke in order to derive the benefits. You just have to laugh and giggle, and you derive the same benefits whether it's after a joke or just giggling for no reason at all.
Well, how's it work, Susie? The group gets together, the laughing yoga class is on. I mean, we've all probably heard of it. You just pretend to laugh and then suddenly you're laughing? Or how's it work?
It's contagious. You can start by pretending to laugh. Like you did with the chimp. It kind of sounds like that.
Yeah.
And then because you have a group, it's very contagious. And the health benefits are incredible, you know, in addition to improving your attitude and changing it from a stressful situation into a more relaxed situation, improving your circulation, lowering your blood pressure. All these benefits people don't realize.
We got a little sound of exactly that kind of class going on. This one happens to be in San Diego with the laughter yogi Michael Coleman. Here you go.
You ready to begin?
Sounds good to me. Is there a physical work out there too, Susie? Susie, what about it? What about the physical side of this? Do you get a benefit? I don't know. Do you get a workout of your diaphragm, I guess? Your blood rate goes
Absolutely.
Up?
Absolutely. It's diaphragmatic breathing. And yes, your stomach muscles are all engaged. To say nothing of your digestive system, your circulation, everything is improved. And it oxygenates your brain. What could be better?
Hard to argue with that. Keep it up, Susie. Thanks. Alice in Chester, Vermont. Alice, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Loud and clear. What do you think?
Well, I just wanted to tell you about the last time I laughed. I'm talking to a girl from England, and for some reason she has the weird verbal tic of using we instead of yes. She's not French at all. So I'm sitting there and I say, why do you always Frenchicize everything?
Yeah.
And I realized how stupid I sounded. And then she started laughing and I started laughing. And the guy who was sitting in call started laughing. And we went around for about 40 minutes just laughing. laughing, and none of us could stop until we got off the call that we were in.
Now, what do you think that's about? Was there something of the meeting of cultures there where you suddenly thought you were being boorish or didn't need to ask it, and she thought, well, why not ask? What do you think that long laugh was about?
I don't know. I think it was, you know, I think we just both realized that I was being silly and kind of boorish, and she just realized she really didn't need to say "we" at me to sound sophisticated.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of our friendship.
Yeah.
But it was hilarious, and I guess she kind of needed to be there, but it was really funny.
Well, that's interesting. Some kind of a breakthrough in friendship, maybe by the candor of acknowledgement of our own absurdity that can come with laughter. I mean, Jack, that's a dynamic I've certainly known, and maybe at the end of a long, long laughing session, we do feel closer to that other person if it's about acknowledging our own foibles.
Yes.
Well, humor humor is varies from society and has varied over history, but laughter is a universal. I'd like to speak to the laughter yoga issue. As was mentioned, laughter yoga involves, as they say, laughing at nothing. And it really is tapping this phenomenon we talked about before, is laughter causes laughter. When someone says hello, you don't have the irresistible urge to go, hello, 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 hello. But when you hear someone laugh, it increases the chance that you're going to laugh along, particularly if there's a group of people. So laughter yoga is really a tapping an important part of human nature. And I think, it's important to have a group of people. Laughter yoga is not going to be very effective if it's just you. Remember, laughter's social, and you need some other people. Yeah. But, it's a very pleasurable experience, particularly for those who self-select for it.
Jacob, what about the bonding aspect here of a good laugh with someone?
Oh yes, you realize you've almost connected on a nonverbal, preverbal, and also pretense, you know, level, some fundamental level with someone else, and that feeling is so important. But you know, the other thing is, laughter is good for your health. Some years ago, Norman Cousins, former editor of the Saturday Review, wrote a book saying that he had had I forget what the disease was, it was incurable.
Yeah.
He sat down and watched the Marx Brothers by the hour, and he recovered. And he became an evangelist for laughter, as in fact the Reader's Digest used to put it, the best medicine.
Yeah, oh, who doesn't remember that? I mean, and who wouldn't like to laugh away a health problem? And maybe we can. I also love the sort of social ritual of laughter. I remember as a kid, spending long days working on the farm. And when the guys would, the older men would get together for a break, let's say you're baling hay, and they'd be there taking a break after a lot of hard work in the shade of a tree, and they almost always took it to a point of laughter where everybody was just cracking up, and really the rest break, you know, hadn't achieved its success until they did that. Or I remember working in a kitchen where the whole kitchen crew would sit down for lunch after everybody else, and if that table didn't come to a full, you know, everybody in it belly laugh before it was over, they hadn't really had their rest and recreation. The laughter was what capped it.
Yeah, as important as the food.
I've got Isaiah here writing online. He asks, is laughter a form of denial or a defense coping mechanism we use to accept the truth? If we couldn't laugh, would we cry all the more? What do you say, Robert?
Well, I think a good place to start is to remember that laughter is unconsciously controlled. We don't make a decision to say, ha ha, it just happens. And so I think we shouldn't think too hard about it, you know, because we have a tendency to rationalize the irrational.
Boy, but when you think about it, there's a lot to think about. I mean, it may be unconscious, but our mind is at work, as we know, all the time, and the absurdity of life seems to be pretty rich pickings.
Well, we particularly laugh in response to discontinuity, for example, mm-hmm. where speech is going on in one direction suddenly swerves off in another. We acknowledge that event by laughter, where someone seems to be doing one thing, and you know, they could slip in the banana peel and fall. that's a surprise, and we tend to acknowledge such things with laughter.
I've got Quincy Jones saying here, I've always thought that a big laugh is a really loud noise from the soul saying, ain't that the truth? We all know how that feels. And Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, saying, with the fearful strain that is on me night and day, if I did not laugh, I should die. I mean, I don't know, Jack. These days, it seems to me, we'd be well off not to avoid the truth, but maybe to raise it higher, to let the laughter stops out a little further.
Yes, and that connection between laughter and the truth, that is so important. It isn't some kind of, you know, fiction. It's something essential is being affirmed, caught, revealed. We all sense that, and I think that's the communal part of it. We can, and even politically, you know, conservatives and liberals can laugh at the same thing, thank heaven, still.
Well, we hope that's true, and the more truth in the laughter, the better. Robert Provine at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, author of Laughter, A Scientific Investigation. Robert, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Pleasure being with you.
And Jack, it's always great to have you. Let's get together for a laugh soon.
Amen.
All right.
Thank you.
We'll go out with Make 'em Laugh from the Glee cast. Listeners, you can continue the conversation at onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Make 'em laugh. Don't you know everyone wants to laugh? Make 'em laugh. 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 Make 'em laugh.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.